Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining the session this afternoon. My name is Thuy Trung, and I'll be the chair for this afternoon's session, which is called Strong Risk Culture Leads to an Effective ICA. Our two presenters today are Martin Lam and Dara Brady. Martin is a director with Deloitte and specialises in life insurance consulting. He has over 22 years of experience in financial services industry in Australia and Asia. He has been CFO and also chief actuary and appointed actuary for several life insurers in Asia. Martin has led numerous actuarial reviews and advice on ICAAP and LAGIC in Australia over the last 3 years. He has also led and was significantly involved in actuarial audits and related reviews for at least eight major life insurers in Australia. Prior to returning to Australia in 2012, Martin was also significantly involved in the implementation of Solvency II for a leading life insurer in the Asia-Pacific region. And Dara is the Chief Risk Officer for Pacific Life Re for both Australian and Asian businesses. Dara has broad international experience in the actuarial, finance and risk management functions. Previously, while heading up the capital management team in CommInsure, he was responsible for ensuring that adequate capital was maintained over time, advising executives on the implications of strategic decisions and leading in implementation of new industry capital standards. Additionally, he has worked in life and pension valuation roles in both Australia and Ireland. So I'll now hand over to Marta and Dara for their presentation.
Good afternoon, everyone. I think we'll just sit here rather than use the lectern, and then I guess we can then take questions as we go along. Firstly, the topic of this session is strong risk culture leads to an effective ICAAP. When we were thinking about what topic to present at the FS Forum back in December 2015, we were thinking that risk culture and how it interacts with ICAAP would be an interesting topic. But we did have a chat back then whether anyone else would find that interesting. But fast forward a few months now, and the recent events in the life insurance industry has made the issue of culture, in particular risk culture, a very topical issue now. So today, what we would like to cover is that an effective organization has a number of cornerstones. And as part of this, how the ICAAP fits in with the risk management framework as well. We'll also look at target risk culture and also risk culture and why it's important to assess the gap between the culture, risk culture and the governance structure as well. We'll also look at what makes a strong risk culture and then also explore situations where risk culture goes wrong. And then finally, we'll discuss the importance of incorporating any gaps in risk culture in the ICAAP. So firstly, when we look at effective organization, we see that it comprises of a number of components. Firstly, there's the vision and strategy that drives everything that the organization does. And then supporting the vision and strategy, there are sound business models and operating models which then enables the company to achieve its strategic objectives. But the business model basically comprises of the various key stakeholders, the offer that the companies make this to these stakeholder groups, which includes clients and staff and so on, as well as the contribution that each stakeholder group makes to the business, and then the resulting financial models. So essentially what is the business and also how it achieves success. Then we have the operating model, which defines the various work processes and systems that are needed to create and deliver the value for each stakeholder group. And last but not least, there's a firm foundation of data analytics and technology, which forms the building blocks, which supports, which I guess plays a significant role to enable the organization to execute on its plans and processes and so on. So for an effective organization, it's important to have two other components, which we call cornerstones, which envelops and also connects the other components together. And they are governance and culture. So strong governance provides the oversight and mechanism that ensures the strategy is executed. And also with that, there also needs to be the right culture that management can then effectively implement its business strategies and objectives. So generally speaking, the right culture means that it allows the organization to pursue its strategic goals within this risk appetite, while also managing the risk of the business, and also meet fulfilling regulatory compliance as well. So that's, in a nutshell, what an effective organ should look like. So firstly, when we focus on governance, what does that mean? And the two areas that we would like to focus on today are the risk management framework and the ICAP. So when you look at the risk management framework as defined in CPS 220, we see that it starts off with the risk appetite statement and risk management strategy. Dara and I had a bit of discussion around whether which one leads first and so on. Sometimes some companies have the risk management, risk appetite statement within the risk management statement, risk management strategy. But then I guess usually the appetite leads the management part. So that, basically that deals with all the risk identification, assessment, mitigations, and then the various stress testing to look at what sort of residual risk there is in the organization. And supporting this is the various policies, process, and procedures that supports the achievement of the risk management strategy. Then you have the business plan on how the company conducts its business and what it looks to achieve. And then you have the ICAP, which is the capital management, capital adequacy part of the framework. And then you have the governance structure and management information system. So what does the ICAP try to do? Basically looks at the residual risk that the company faces, and then it looks at what sort of capital is required. So firstly, what we look at is the pillar one risk, which is what you have in the regulatory capital. So it's things like market risk, insurance risk, operational risk. But that is mainly to achieve the policy liability within a probability of sufficiency of 1 in 200. But over and above that, companies try to maintain a buffer of, say, I think 1 in 50. I think most people are using that now in the industry, that they also do not breach the regulatory capital. And then you look at the various components of market risk, insurance risk, and operational risk as part of that. The next element is then look at what risk that the that's not covered as part of Pillar 2. So this is over and above that. So for some model risk, to the extent that model risk is not covered adequately as part of the operational risk, for example, you need to set aside additional capital. The next element there is around the risks that are not covered at all under Pillar 1. And for example, future capital needs, which then you need to set aside capital to cover that. And then last but not least, when you do the various stress and scenario and so on, you identify situations where you need additional capital, and that's where you need to set aside capital. So in total, this gives you your total capital requirement. And then you look at the various capital resources you have, tier one, tier two, and see how well that covers your capital requirement, and companies calculates capital adequacy ratio and things like that to work out the extent to which they cover their capital requirement. So basically, this provides the governance framework to look at risk and capital. And underlying all this is actually a risk culture that supports the achievement of these objectives. And so it's very important that we look at the culture that underlies the ICAP as well as part of this process. And so I'll hand over now to Dara to talk about more about culture.
Thanks, Martin. So before I start into risk culture, I thought it would be worthwhile just touching on organizational culture. So organizational culture refers to the values, beliefs, and behaviors that characterize an organization and define its nature. So it's rooted in an organization's goals, strategies, and structure, and its approaches to its employees, customers, investors, and the greater community. So effectively, the target culture then is the values, beliefs, and behaviors that the organization expects and elicits in employees and other stakeholders. A target culture could, for example, incorporate elements like acting with integrity, open, honest, and transparent communication, accountability and ownership, innovation, collaboration. So today we're focusing on both culture and risk culture. So risk culture is a subset of the broader organizational culture. And it determines and results from the decisions and behaviors that are rewarded, encouraged, accepted, and tolerated within the organization. It's the behaviors that happen when no one is watching. Now, risk culture and overall culture, there needs to be an alignment with the organization's risk frameworks and governance principles, which we will discuss further in the following slides. So CPS 220 requires the board to form a view on the risk culture of the organization, and to the extent that this culture supports the ability of the institution to operate consistently within its risk appetite. So how is this generally approached? So market practice is generally to conduct employee surveys and interviews with senior management, and the results of this are considered year on year. But a question we asked ourselves when discussing this topic was, are the surveys targeted enough to determine what the requirement is, which is that the culture supports the risk appetite of the organization? So while the assessment is needed, we believe that it's also necessary to take this further, and we'll explore some of the benefits of taking this further. So as we've discussed, target culture needs to be set to support the ability of the institution to operate consistently within its risk appetite. Actual culture should be assessed and any gaps identified. So what governance and target culture give is they give the expected outcomes. So that's what is expected under both normal and stress circumstances. The actual culture is a key driver of the actual outcomes. So this is an example of form versus substance. So is a company going through the motions, or do they live and breathe their values, beliefs, and behaviors? If form is good but substance is not there, it can have some disastrous consequences, and Martin will touch on these later. So traditionally, ICAPs have considered the risk appetite and the business strategy of the organization and coming up with the amount of capital that's needed. But effectively in doing this, without considering the actual culture of the organization, you're assuming that there's minimal gaps and a strong alignment between the actual and target culture. So the ICAP should be considering these gaps and not only allow for the risk appetite and business strategy. So strong alignment from an ICAP perspective would be consistently embedding the ICAP in the decision-making process, i.e. the use test of the ICAP. So why bother doing this? What's the benefit? What's the value? So as Martin has discussed, culture is one of the cornerstones of an effective organization. By identifying the desirable changes and taking steps to address these, an organization has a much greater chance of achieving its strategic objectives. So I'll pass back over to Martin, and he'll give an overview of how to set a target risk culture.
So what makes a strong risk culture? Firstly, a strong risk culture starts and ends with leadership. Management needs to show leadership and communicate a clear strategy, and always discuss the importance of risk management frequently. They must also be continually looking at ways to improve risk management, and then also set appropriate organization structure, reporting lines, and authority levels. There should also be a general awareness of what the risk strategy is, and then what the appetite and policies that a company has, and as well as the benefits and impacts of managing risk. And basically, you know, each of the stakeholders of an organization needs to be aware of what's in it for them. So I guess what's in it for me, answering that question. There's also, within an organization, the roles and responsibilities are clear. I know that we've discussed about the three lines of defense in earlier session, and this is the one of the current models to set responsibility between first line, second line, in terms of managing oversight of risk, and then the third line in terms of assurance. And this is a good model to use. But then there's also needs to be collaborative relationship between the various functions. One of the telling signs when you do an ICAP review is you can interview the senior people and they'll know what to say. But then when you start interviewing the risk managers, then they might be telling you things about that they're not getting a lot of collaborations from the various actuarial or finance function in filling the risk registers and so on. Then you can sort of tell from that what their risk culture is like within the business. So how businesses collaborate, various teams collaborate is also very important. in terms of remuneration and performance measurement, that's also so key. Obviously, there shouldn't be any conflict within the remuneration to risk management, and risk management should always be an area that is part of performance reviews and things like that. Last but not least, there should be regular reporting and assessment of how the company is tracking against key risk indicators. Basically, what doesn't get measured doesn't get managed, so it's important to find out how the company is going in terms of the various key risk indicators. So we thought we'll go through an example of two organizations where they are identical in every sense, except that one has a strong risk culture and one has a weak risk culture. So how do you think that the ICAP outcomes between these two organizations would look like? So, does anyone want to make any comments about that? Should one hold more capital than another or not?
I think what you're saying is that a company with a weak risk culture is blind to the fact that it is a weak risk culture, so therefore they don't realize that they would need to hold additional capital. But the question is, should they in practice be holding additional capital? If somebody came into that organization and could spot the weaknesses and the gaps, what advice would they give? And that's going to be kind of the flow on to some of the conversation. So what we're trying to get to is, this is an important part of the ICAP, but all you're doing is, as you say, it's a bandage solution. You're holding more capital because there's more risk in the organization. But what you really want to be doing is influencing the change and actually driving the changes in the culture, which would then mean you could then hold less capital because you'd have a stronger and more risk-sensitive culture.
So in those sort of situations, as the appointed actuary or the capital actuary, how should we go about influencing the company to either change its risk culture or find ways to increase capital? I mean, for example, if a firm management is strong in pushing for sales and overriding some of the risk controls, things like that, to get a better, to get more deals in without thinking about the consequences of deals, what should you do as an actuary in those situations, setting aside, looking at capital and risk management then?
I think another way of thinking about it is about if you go back to your framework, you start with the risk appetite statement and risk management strategy, and some of having a weak risk culture, whatever that's defined as, insurance savings, the surprises that management gets about results. And that should go to the risk appetite statement. And, for example, you might say, we're actually quite happy having volatility in earnings because we're more aggressive than some things. So in that situation, you might say we don't need capital to cover the earnings volatility. However, if it comes into issues like, we might make mistakes that cost us a lot of money because I'm able to make claims, that will sort of very different capital outcome in terms of the innovation or the earnings culture. But the actuary somehow has to navigate that field as well. In what respect?
Good response. So I suppose it depends on the situation, and I guess you need to try and influence management to some extent, but then depending on the outcome they want to achieve, then the level of capital will depend on that outcome.
Yeah, no, I think you've made a very good point, but I think if the organization is risk aware and understanding the risk and the volatility in earnings, what you're effectively saying is that they should be feeding that awareness back into the setting of the risk appetite. So they're willing to accept those risks, but there needs to be an understanding of what they're actually accepting.
That's a question. How do you go about doing that? Okay, so we'll look at a few cases here where the culture or the risk culture has gone wrong, and some of these organizations are no longer with us today. For example, HIH, there wasn't enough focus on the pricing and reserving and so on, and you've got management overriding risk controls and things like that, and that led to their downfall. So I think basically, without going into a lot more detail for some of these firms, which it might be a bit sensitive to some people, I suppose if you can look at what we have up there, I think the key themes among these organizations is that there's inadequate focus on risk controls and some personalities within management overriding some of these risk controls, focusing on there was not enough escalation of issues, keeping bad news from management and things like that are key themes that run through all these organizations.
Okay. So now I'm just going to discuss how effectively as actuaries we can consider the risk culture of the organization, the actual risk culture of the organization, as part of the ICAP process. So there's some of the practical implications of this. So if you did see that there was a gap between what your target risk culture and your governance framework versus what the actual culture was, where you might need to make an allowance for these gaps. So in some ways you could see the culture as the personality of the organization. So some people in a stressful situation, they thrive, other people crumble. So in the same way, the risk culture and the overall culture of an organization will influence how that organization manages stress. So stress testing obviously remains quite a hot topic, and the industry stress tests that occurred last year, APRA, are expected to provide feedback shortly. So stress testing, it should be embedded in an organization. In my view, the real value from stress testing comes from some of the insights that come out of stress testing rather than just focusing on the financial outcomes. And so consideration of the culture can help a scenario come to life and identify aspects that may need to be challenged. So, for example, if a company sees itself as having an innovative culture, it's much better placed to cope with a disruptor entering the market. Conversely, if an organization does not have a culture of speaking up, it may take a lot longer for the bad experience to come to light and the company to take action, so the actual severity of the scenario could increase dramatically. So another thing to consider is that generally companies, when doing stress and scenario testing, they assume that management actions can occur, but are they considering whether the culture of the organization helps or inhibits the effect of actions taking place? So the board should be considering the culture of the organization in challenging the effectiveness of management actions as part of the stress testing exercises. Again, it's an area of substance versus form. So a lot of organizations have a very well articulated capital response plan, so the actions that they would take in these scenarios, but have these been robustly tested? So an organization should be looking to build a strong risk culture when times are good to ensure they're in the best position to cope with the inevitable stresses that will occur. So, operational risk. So given the definition of operational risk, people and conduct risk is obviously a key consideration. So under LAGIC, the operational risk charge is a reasonably blunt formulaic approach, and it's not very reflective of the true risks in the organization. So are companies considering the culture of the organization and assessing the amount of capital they need to hold under their ICAP, for example, in either target surplus or working capital? So some of the considerations that companies could potentially incorporate into the ICAP are so whether reputation damage could lead to lapsing of very profitable business, which is supporting the capital of the business, or anti-selective lapsation that could lead to deterioration in the quality of the book. So another consideration is that operational risk modeling, it varies in sophistication, but it's generally frequency severity modeling with consideration of internal loss data. So going back to the example of the two identical companies, if one has a strong risk culture and a raising incidence, they're going to have much richer loss events data than a company that isn't raising those incidents. So are companies considering that in determining what operational risk capital they should be holding to truly reflect the risk in the organization? So finally, some considerations from an insurance risk perspective. So APRA provided some feedback to the interpretations task force, the LAGIC interpretations task force, and effectively said that it's appropriate for the appointed actuary to allow for specific risks in the organization in setting stress margins, and that the operational risk charge, effectively what I've already said about it being a blunt formulaic approach. So the LAGIC task force talked about considering internal and external risks to the organization in setting your margins. So as an internal risk in setting these margins, potentially appointed actuaries should be considering the culture of the organization. So given recent events, remuneration for claim staff has become quite topical. CBS 510 has traditionally focused on REM for risk and financial control personnel. However, APRA have been increasingly investigating what the REM policies around claims management is and whether there's policies that could lead to bad customer outcomes. So, for example, if the REM is linked to decline rates, if the culture is one of no bad news. So what this can actually do is change an insurance risk into a more binary reputation risk. So from an actuarial perspective, one of the considerations here is also how reflective past experiences of the future. So if these things start to come to light in setting your reserves, how do you allow for the fact that your past experience is potentially reflective of a time where claims management practices were stricter? So something else to consider is the alignment between reinsurers, insurers, and trustees. So again, a hot topic for the industry, that misalignment should not be allowed to get in the way of good customer outcomes. So there's a view that following poor experience for reinsurers, that they've been putting pressure on insurers to tighten claims management practice. So from a cultural perspective, there should be a culture of collaboration between these. And effectively, the outcome is to ensure that there's good customer outcomes. So misalignment should not be allowed to cause poor customer outcomes. So there should be a culture of seeing value through this chain and not looking to win, which could, again, lead to bad outcomes. So just to wrap up, so governance and cultures are cornerstones of an effective organization. Both are needed. Target culture needs to be set to support the ability of the institution to operate consistently within its risk appetite. The actual culture should then be assessed and any gaps identified. So the ICAP should be considering these gaps and not only considering the risk appetite of the organization and its business strategy. And a key consideration in understanding this is the how embedded the ICAP is in the decision-making process. And I'll pass over for any questions.
Great. Thanks, Martin and Dara. So we now have about 15 minutes for any questions. So if you have any questions, if you could please make your way up to the microphone in the middle there, please state your name and ask away.
Thanks for that. My name's Alan. I'm from Colonial Asset Management. My question is, how well equipped do you think actuaries are at assessing risk culture and therefore considering that as part of the ICAP? Number of challenges include, I guess, culture being fairly intangible, whether the actuaries in the organisation have sufficient visibility, access, authority to, I guess, access various parts of the business to really assess the actual risk culture. In some organisations, even senior management aren't aware of challenges to risk culture in the broader organisation. You've got scenarios where, as you pointed out, actual and sort of what expected in terms of the culture can be quite different. Most organisations, if not all, will have clear representation of what their vision is, what their what they aspire to. Whether that actually plays out in practice is a completely different matter. So I know it's a lengthy question.
Thanks for the question. I suppose, as I mentioned earlier, the way you find out how the risk culture is like in an organization, and as I said, when I was doing ICAP reviews, is to conduct interviews and talk to the people that are involved with risk management and so on to understand how the organization behaves. And if, like, even filling out a risk register, whether it's like a form filling thing where you go from a gross risk rating of the impact and probability to what is done to mitigate those risks and impacts to your net rating. That process by itself is quite telling sign of the actual way in which risk is managed. Because sometimes the departments just spend 15 minutes to say, oh, I have to fill in this form for this quarter and get it done. And so this is how the risk has evolved over the period, or whether they seriously have discussions and you see how that's changed over time with the risk team and who's involved in those decisions and what's the outcome. That is also, that's a very telling sign, especially at the risk manager level where you work with them and understand, you know, that process. You can see, because the risk register goes, summarizes all the risks within the organization. So you can tell from that as a first point of call, I guess. I guess the other aspects is looking at how the history of the errors in, for example, unit pricing. You can have one event and then, usually companies come up with, we need to hold capital for unit pricing error, and this is the amount of capital we need to hold for a 1 in 10 year event and things like that. But then how did they come up with that sort of estimate? And then you look at the various history of various errors that's happened in the past, and you see a repetitive sort of scenario where errors keep repeating itself. And so you see the attitude towards trying to fix things out, fixing things for the first time, or whether they're allowed to continue to make errors and all that. So I guess that the attitude towards making sure things are done right is also a telling sign.
So I thought I'd just briefly add. So in the previous session, Mike Thornton talked about actuaries and their involvement in risk management. And one of the things that he mentioned was whether appointed actuaries in performing the assessment of the risk management framework, they should be more challenging. So in performing this assessment, one of the areas the appointed actuary could potentially challenge is the company's assessment of its culture. So that's, again, and that's a way for the appointed actuary to get access to whatever culture, employee survey, assessments, etc. are happening within the organization.
Elaine Collins, I'm a non-executive director, so I'm going to ask a question from a director's point of view. Thank you for that presentation. I particularly liked your clarity around target risk culture and actual risk culture and the gap between it. Oh, that was a really good way of expressing it. My question is around policies and procedures, and you covered a little bit around risk management responsibilities and regular reporting and so on, because clearly a big impact on the actual risk culture is the frontline people, how they execute their role and the risks that they take into account when they're doing that. So my question is around kind of the company's policies and procedures. Do you think that if those are clear and succinct, that they help the frontline people to execute their roles with a better risk culture?
Good question. Again, some similar topics are coming up. So yes, I think clear policies and procedures obviously have a place, but one of the things that as risk professionals we need to be getting better at doing, and actuaries in general, is getting embedded in the business. So if the risk is getting embedded in line one and educating them about topics like risk culture and why these things are important. So policies are good, but actions are needed as well.
All about how the risk appetite translates down to the frontline people.
So maybe just add to that comment that, well, sometimes it depends on what the policy is. And so, for example, in the case that we all know is the claims team, management team will interpret the requirement to pay a claim based on certain definitions. And if they just follow that without thinking through some of what the policies mean, then I guess that's could be an area where there's too much focus on a particular area that gets carried through rather than sitting back and thinking about what does it mean for the customer and the business in general.
Hi, Dara. Hi, Martin. Ian Craig here. Measurement of risk culture. I'm just interested, you sort of said it's going to be linked to pay and performance, and you touched on the fact that surveys don't seem like necessarily the best way. Just wondering if you, what you guys consider would be really good practice that you've seen in the market so far. And whether that actually leads to, whether you've seen that lead to a better outcome for companies. Sorry, yeah, so I'm just looking for examples of how do you actually measure risk culture, and whether you've seen that have a flow and effect to better to actually better risk culture. So what are the best companies doing around measurement of risk culture?
So from personal experience, a lot of companies are still relying on the employee survey type approaches, but I think one of the things that companies need to be better at is being more targeted in the questions that they ask. So making sure that the questions then align to what the fundamentals of the risk culture should be doing, which is supporting the risk appetite of the organization. So other areas, obviously, so workshop settings, sometimes if you having a workshop and sitting down with more junior employees and getting their view on what the culture in the organization is, so making that an area where they can be open and honest in their feedback rather than just focusing on kind of the senior staff. And What you tend to hear is that the view from the top can be quite different from the view below. So getting an idea of both obviously provides additional insights. And touching on tone from the top. So if you have a strong leader in the organization who is sending those messages, so if some of the messages that they're, sending out are around more long-term focus, less chasing short-term objectives, those type of things. So if you're seeing that through the organization, then obviously that influences a positive risk culture.
Alan Merton. I'm interested, I think one of the questions before was sort of going to how do actuaries play in this? What's the role that actuaries play? How do we get the right tool sets to be able to add something to these discussions? Often risk culture, I think you alluded to, comes down to a strong boss who doesn't listen to anybody who has a lot of decision-making authority. Can the actuary stand up to that? What are your views on how we, if we want to play in this, how do we as individuals in a profession get tooled up to be influential and make sure that we strengthen the organisations that we're working for?
I think in my view is that basically the actuary should perform the role of an advisor. And so if they're seeing these sort of risks and what these risks are and then understanding the implications of that, and also, as you mentioned, what does it mean in terms of the P&L, what is in terms of capital and so on, and then having that sort of discussions with the management board about the implications of of the risk that we can see, and also the financial and other impacts, then I guess putting that in front of them will then help them decide what sort of course of action that they should take. Obviously, the board and management CEO also have their own responsibility, and so we as actually should perform the role of the advisor and understand, let them know the implications of the risk and the financial impacts.
I think we're good at the financials. I'm not sure that we've always had the tools to talk about the non-financial aspects. And so I like asking questions without thinking of the answers, Jez, you know that. But I think some of the answer to it is that we tend to understand the breadth of where the important decisions are being made. So if I think about why we can be part of the process, it's because we know where things could go seriously wrong. And the biggest problem with risk registers is how do you decide at what level to focus risks on, not based on frequency and severity, but do you get right down to the nitty-gritty? And I think we're pretty good from our background and training at thinking about where are things really going to potentially go wrong and therefore helping to probe. I like what Martin said about the role of the advisor. That's often easier externally than it is internally. But most actuaries have been able to find other jobs if they leave companies. So we're still in a position where, we have options, but I think some of it does come down to confidence. And I think we've got some of the tools, but the communication stuff, the knowing what other tools are around, like surveys and how to use them and when to use them, but understanding much more broadly the operational things that could go wrong seems to me part of what we need to do as individuals in a profession.
Okay, any final questions? Okay. Could you please join me in thanking Martin and Dara for their presentation?